Welcome to another episode of the Tech Exec Series for NTP Podcast. Today we're down in Melbourne for the first time with Matt Vitale, Exec Director.
Yes.
And new dog. Awesome, Matt.
Thanks for having me.
Mate, super excited to be here today. I think it's you're on a big journey at the moment. You're right in the thick of the AI space. It's the topic everyone's talking about.
Yeah.
But you got a really interesting background before that.
Yeah.
Let's start at your background for people that don't know who you are. Let's go through that. Lawyer, virtual, where we're at today.
Look, I've recently joined New Dialogue as an executive director. So, really keen to share a bit about that. But I've just come off about 6 months of career break, a pause. I co-founded and ran Birchall, which is Australia's largest equity crowdfunding platform. I ran that business for 8 years. We were among the pioneers of equity crowdfunding in Australia. It's a new regime, a really exciting contribution to the fundraising landscape. And, you know, we helped business raise over $250 million, over 300 successful offers. That journey was incredible. It was, an amazing and really rewarding ride to be on. But after 8 years at it, I for a variety of reasons, just felt like I needed a break. I suppose here I am after some travel. Went to Colombia, spent some time in Japan, and then started working with a few businesses, doing consulting and advisory. I'm a lawyer by background, I still have a practicing certificate, and it was great to just get back working with people that are building things again, and getting really deeply embedded in, some of their most difficult problems that range from go-to-market to capital raising. And then working with Todd and the team at New Dialogue, it became apparent that they've got something that's pretty special, and the time is right, and there's some exciting things that have happened even this week that validate that they've got something really special. And what I've learned is, you need to go fast, and nothing can be truer than that in this environment as well.
Well, especially in this day and age. Mate, we'll get to that space real quick. You mentioned a couple of things there.
Yeah.
The story from legal to a fintech startup, was that scratching your own itch? Was you seen an opportunity in the market? How did that come about? What started that journey for you for virtual?
My journey to becoming a lawyer was took a winding track in itself. I think that's probably, if I reflect on my life, it has been a long and winding journey with, lots of really diverse experiences, which has been awesome.
And it's probably set you up really well to be in the position you're at now, working with different industries, different verticals.
I think that's true of everyone, if we're being honest. Like, you are where you are, and, your story kind of informs the contribution that you can make wherever you find yourself. But yes, absolutely, because I've had lots of really diverse experiences. I probably wasn't a great student when I was first out of high school. Took a gap year. I lived in Vietnam for a few months. I traveled Europe. I came back, started a sugarcane juice machine. I was probably 15 years ahead of the curve. It was like importing machines and then manufacturing them locally. It was absolute disaster.
Yeah.
Took, 6 years to complete an arts degree, probably because I was spending too much time in nightclubs and kind of, promoting and getting people to, come and drink on a Thursday night. And then at some point I felt like I needed to grow up and I needed a professional backing, and I was inspired by what's called an admission ceremony, which my girlfriend at the time was admitted as a lawyer, and Chief Justice explained in the legal profession, you know, there's this concept of lawyers being officers of the court and having a higher duty, you know, to the law and to the court, even over and above their clients, which was a novel concept for me at the time, and I was really taken by it. And then I got into a postgraduate law degree at Monash. And, you know, from a six-year arts degree, I finished the law degree in 2 years. But I was just – when I had shown myself that when I'm on mission, when I, like, really want to go after something, I can make it happen really quickly.
That's probably fantastic career advice for anyone, right? Like, you can dabble in things, but when you see somebody that's super passionate about an area, they're the people whose careers, you know, career trajectory accelerates phenomenally, right?
Totally. I think I was lucky. There was a lot of, like, good fortune there. I had, you know, great people around me that, you know, that supported me and were nudging me in the right direction. Like, many times that I could have gone off the rails, but, you know, that's partly about me, that's partly about the people that I surrounded myself with, but I kind of always remained in the system, yeah. I suppose. But when I was on, you know, I was like, this is what I want to do, this is what I need to do, and, you know, it was hard work, but it wasn't hard, if that makes sense. And then, yeah, you know, I was fortunate enough to get a job at a pretty good law firm, and fortunate because it was like the wake of the GFC. It was a really difficult time, but then my legal career was it was really, you know, rewarding. Like, I hear lots of people that, you know, say terrible things about, you know, private practice, and, you know, I'm not in it anymore, right? So, like, it wasn't a good fit long term for me. But the things that I learned in that environment, there's real value in that. And got the opportunity to work with some amazing clients. I specialized in financial services,
yeah, right.
And that then, I suppose, kind of led me to what would come next with equity crowdfunding. And I saw what was happening in the UK in the space, and helping large clients raise capital, seeing how complicated, risky, and expensive it was,
yep.
And then seeing that, you know, if you're a big business, you have all of these options to source capital, but for small businesses, you know, the options are pretty narrow. That anything that could be done to, like, broaden the field would be better for everyone from a systems perspective, because, you know, the status quo tended towards, you know, favors large incumbents.
Yeah.
So that was something I got really passionate about. And I remember talking to partners that I was working for, what's happening in the UK? This is going to be a thing. And, you know, some were supportive, but most were like, this is never going to happen. Like, you know, early stage business venture, it's an asset class, too risky for retail investors. But then the government put out a discussion paper, and I, you know, I had the chutzpah to, you know, make a humble submission. And then that put me on the radar for a range of people that were in the space. And I just started having conversations, and then met my co-founder at Birchall, Alan, who had started a reward crowdfunding platform, and we got working together on, you know, how we could make a contribution to the space.
Yeah, wow. Mate, you just mentioned there, you mentioned network a couple of times. You put yourself in the right space, surrounded by the right people.
Yeah.
And then you started with a co-founder.
Yep.
I think that startup journey for a lot of people, if you're in an individual, can be really challenging.
Yep.
What's the importance for you in hindsight on having that right co-founder?
For me at the time, there were lots of things that, like, I just didn't know about the startup space. Yep. I was a lawyer and really startup space, you know, I'm talking, what, 2016. You know, it was pretty nascent back then.
Yeah,
like, it's just changed a bit. You know, it's changed so much. And I think at Birchall, like, we did made a big contribution to accelerating the development of you know, the startup ecosystem. But Yeah, absolutely. Having someone that complements your skills, I think, is really important. But also, and, you know, given my time again, I think, you know, some of the things I learned about myself was just to back myself more at those critical moments. But these are things that, you know, you learn over time.
Yeah, and would obviously set you up really well for, you know, the second coming or this new venture as well.
Yeah.
Mate, just on the virtual part for a second, biggest success stories, I know I've read quite a few and do my background on you, but mate, biggest success stories or things you look back on really positively in that journey?
Look, there were so many. Sheba Rideshare was probably the first breakout success, and, you know, that was 2019. We helped them raise $3 million. And George McEncrow was, you know, such an inspiring founder, and probably the perfect story for Birchall, because he was someone that had an amazing idea, you know, deep understanding of her customers. You know, for listeners that don't know, like Sheba Rideshare was an all-women rideshare for, you know, as an alternative to Uber.
Yeah.
So women riders, women drivers, and they, I suppose, captivated, you know, the hearts and minds of their users, because, you know, George had high conviction that this was a service that was absolutely needed, you know, deep empathy for, you know, customers and drivers, but she couldn't raise capital. It's, you know, it was probably, you know, the highest profile, you know, demonstration of a founder that was underserved by, you know, this ecosystem that's there to support innovation. And she came to us, and I think the statistic was like 94% of the investors in that round were female investors.
Fantastic.
Yeah. And it became an archetype that then made us a lightning rod for all of these people that saw the opportunity of building a community, you know, to raise capital. Unfortunately, like for Sheba, you know, Melbourne was kind of where they had their biggest footprint, and, you know, we've headed into COVID, and if any business is going to struggle, you know, probably an undercapitalized rideshare business, you know, in the midst of the lockdowns are going to kind of meet some challenges. But, you know, but for, you know, our partnership and how we helped them raise that capital, you know, they wouldn't have gotten to the point that they did, and the service still exists. So, which is great, but obviously it wasn't the, you know, ultimate investment outcome that everyone wanted. But it's probably the story that, you know, fills me with pride the most, because I think it's a big reason why Birchall is needed and exists, is that it does level the playing field for ideas. That, you know, if you've got a good idea and you work hard and you know, are building in response to demand, and you can tell that story, then, you know, it's possible to make magic happen.
Yeah, I think you mentioned that there's a couple of parts that I really, really love, is that storytelling element and the building a community. And I think, as you said, that lesson and the success there has continually evolved in the startup space as well. And that storytelling and building of a community and then building a product for that community is that real formula right now. For it doesn't have to be the greatest and latest tech, but it just has to be something that serves a purpose for a community. And that's the thing that's having some success, especially in the crowdfunding space.
Yeah, absolutely. And it should be intuitive, right? And, you know, I'd see this a lot with founders. I don't know what it is, but there's often a reluctance to just get out there and talk to customers. And, you know, I have to be mindful of my spiritual detours a lot, but like, because it's, you know, it's an important part of my life. But I think it says a lot about us as individuals, this fear of rejection, this fear of failure. You know, you have a conversation with someone and you're underprepared and maybe you look stupid, and And I think a lot of these things hold people back from just getting out there and talking to customers. And often, you know, at an extreme example, we'll see people that have invested, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars in a solution, but haven't chatted to a customer.
Yeah.
And there's so much that can be done, particularly with all of the tools that are available now, to just get out there and talk to people and build in response to what they want. And we sometimes see this with people that are like, you know, real subject matter experts in their field. And they may be right, and the market may not be on their level of intelligence, but you got to meet people where they are. And it's, yeah, it's kind of getting back to basics. Like, what is the problem that you're solving? Who cares about it? Will they pay for it and bill for that?
Yeah, the third part right there, will they pay for it, right? Like, I think, and I've spoken about this many times, there's 1,000 really well-built apps in the App Store, architected beautifully, codes schmick. No one knows about the apps because they don't have a need or nobody wants them.
Yeah.
And it's happening right now in the AI space where you can be the best engineer going around, write something beautifully. No one knows about it. It's not really solving a problem. There's other people out there making a lot of money right now, just wrapping a bunch of different products together, throwing a little bow on top, and it serves a purpose and people are prepared to pay for it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'd say often, like, and maybe, you know, doing ourselves out of work at Birchall, but, you know, best source of capital is revenue.
Mm.
It's like, you know, if you can sell something to someone, like, just do that.
Yeah.
And, you know, raise capital for the right reasons. Now, this isn't true in every scenario, but I think it's mostly true. You know, capital raising, it should be easy. Like, you want to get to the point where it's a no-brainer. Like, yeah. I'd say, like, it's just add capital. Like, yeah. There's, you know, these just add water scenario. It's just like, this thing's ready to go. You just add water and it grows. And that's how you should view capital. You get to this position where it's just like, you know, we've done everything that we can possibly do with the resources that we have, but we're actually at this point where we've thought of everything and all we need is the capital. Like, just simplify it for investors.
Yeah, it's an acceleration tool, right?
Absolutely.
And it's especially in the software game, because software is so easy to spin up now and so cheap to spin up. Products are a little bit different, but if you can get a product even in an MVP stage and then get somebody to actually try it, like it, and then, you know, put their dollars in the pocket, then you can actually turn product and, you know, start to scale that out. That is the harder one, I imagine, for the real need for, I guess, crowdfunding platform as well. Like, that, the real product, hardcore product, is that point of differentiation, whereas software, significantly easier and cheaper.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. We, you know, as the business evolved at Birchall, we saw where we felt that the market was underserved and, you know, we had a role to play. So last year, we were fortunate to receive a $300,000 grant from LaunchVic to stand up a specialized angel network focusing specifically on hardware technology businesses.
Yeah, beautiful.
Because we just heard all the time from founders that, you know, investors don't like hardware. Like, it's too risky, it's too, you know, complicated. And then some hardware businesses doing everything that they could to describe themselves as software businesses.
Yeah.
But, you know, we also had a good understanding of the investors in our audience. You know, Birchall had audience 300,000 members on the platform, and, you know, some really active investors. And they're not just mum and dad investors, you know, in contrast to the, you know, generally, you know, held belief that it's just kind of mum and dad's putting in small amounts of money. You know, there are some pretty sophisticated investors that like the direct access to a founder that a platform like Birchall gives. But many of them want to invest in hardware businesses for a variety of reasons. Maybe they've made money in hardware, you know, and they feel like they're able to add value or, you know, assess the risks. So we got a grant to set up this network, and it was amazing. We, you know, put a stake in the ground and say, this is what we're for. You know, we think that there are some amazing hardware technology stories in Australia, and, you know, we want we want to be the place where founders and investors can find them. And it's still underway, but we raised for three hardware businesses in the last 3 months of last year, just under $2 million. Mm. And it is by far and away been the most successful specialized angel network that LaunchVic has funded. And, barely 12 months in.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Up in Newcastle as well, there's an organization called The Melt doing the exact same thing, accelerating a fund, specializing in hardware.
Yeah.
And they've got quite a few success stories at the moment. Difference is it's a longer game to get that money out. So it's a different investment theory. Like if you're looking for that quick win, that quick exit, it's a longer play. But as you said, there's people that specialize in that, have that longer game approach. And there's a massive upside there as well.
Yeah.
But there was a big need for it because Australia I guess across the world it was always software. Yeah, that's where you're seeing the big X's, the big returns, the big multipliers, right?
Yeah. Except that like there are some amazing stories in Australia that they're just not told enough.
Correct.
So, you know, people think of Cochlear and absolutely, you know, amazing, but like Neura.
Yep.
You know, John Gregory's business, Vitruvian, amazing. He built it from Perth, from his garage. Like there are just so many of these stories that need to be told.
Correct.
So then people are out there, if I see it, I can be it.
Yeah.
So
it's that storytelling element again, right?
Absolutely.
No, perfect. Mate, we'll get out of that journey into your next journey in a second, but I think there's one part in the middle, which is often not spoken about in the startup world. Startups and founder success stories are very sexy, great to put in the newspapers, great to hear of your multiples returns. But you did have 6 months off earlier this year. You mentioned the word burnout. I think when you're a founder, you're all in on a business, very hard to turn your mind off at night, I imagine, very hard to not take that call after hours, the email first thing in the morning. And talk to me about that journey, that decision to actually to take that break, because I think it's a really important one and something that should be spoken about in this space.
Yeah. No, thank you. It's, look, as you say, like you can't switch off. I had a co-founder. I ended up being a solo founder. That brought its challenges. If I look back, the things that we achieved, I was often the shock absorber. Like the externality was me and my well-being and my health on so many levels. But you do it. And we had a particularly brutal year last year, 24. So like we raised capital at the end of 23 on a positive growth agenda. You know, we'd had our second busiest quarter ever. We were expecting, 2024 to be a great year.
Yeah.
It's a seasonal business. So January, February's, typically a quiet period for raising capital because, people love going to the beach, not really thinking about investing. Or I think it's more the point that they're not thinking about working on their offer documents. It's more on the company side of getting ready. It's actually a really good time to raise capital, but we'll see. We were running pretty rich perhaps seduced by the pipeline and expecting that things were going to improve, and then the growth just didn't show up, and activity was still strong, but like all the funding volumes were a lot lower, we needed to take action quickly. And as a regulated business, you can't sail as close to the wind as other businesses can.
Yeah.
We needed to implement a pretty drastic cost out program, and that was really hard because in a business like ours, it's people, it was a tough thing to navigate, but we got through it well. It's like we need to do more with less fundamentally. And the team, you know, the team all rallied around this mission and, you know, saw like how everyone was pitching in. And, you know, I kind of talk about how hard it was for me, but, you know, it was equally and perhaps, you know, harder for the team. I had agency, but, you know, they were kind of, you know, part of the mission and needed to support me, and they did, and trust that we were going to get through, and we did. You know, that specialized angel network I mentioned, you know, that was us accelerating into, you know, this, I suppose, existential crisis by introducing new revenue lines and thinking differently about business and thinking bigger, which these near-death experiences kind of thrust upon you. It's probably a little bit frustrating that, you know, you look at, geez, look at what we achieved with, you know, two-thirds of the team.
And it takes that crisis for you to make that pivot or to have that acceleration, which is, in hindsight, you know, why did it take that as well?
But yeah,
it's often the case for many organizations, right? It takes a bit of a crisis or something to have a look differently.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think we
navigated it really well and introduced new revenue lines, a bunch of things that we've been talking about for years. We accelerated literally in a matter of weeks. And, you know, so cost out, revenue up, job done. And, you know, the team and the way that we all kind of rallied to do that was just inspiring. But as a seasonal business, you know, our cash reserves probably weren't going to get us through that January, February period. And as I mentioned, being a regulated business, like we just can't, you know, sail as close to the wind as other businesses. So back raising capital, second time within a 12-month period. And it was all capital raisings are difficult. And, you know, we raised over $2 million in the week before Christmas.
Wow.
Yeah, because, you know, there was a belief in what we were doing, and it was extremely, you know, validating and to have that support. But, like, throughout this whole period, you know, there was some, you know, personal challenges that, you know, that I was kind of working through as well. And in any other business, yeah, you'd probably, you know, take a few months off, but you can't do that in a startup business. It's, you know, your mic drop and maybe the company dies. Yeah. And I suppose kind of pushing through to, you know, save the company essentially and kind of guide it through, you know, another existential period. At the end of all of that, I was cooked. Like, there's a price to pay. And so over the break, you know, I started to, you know, think about, like, where I was at and, you know, if I was right. And, you know, probably wasn't. And it was obvious I needed to, you know, step away. And then things kind of, like, moved really quickly. And I'm happy to say, you know, Birchall now has an awesome CEO in Kirsten Hunter. You know, the board moved really swiftly to, you know, put in place a, you know, interim CEO or you know, managing the CEO transition. And then, you know, it was so lucky that Kirsten fell in love with the business and the opportunity and threw her hat in the ring for it. And it's, you know, it's on its own journey now.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, it's not founder-led anymore, but it gets to kind of live on, you know, with, I suppose, a fresher perspective and someone that, you know, I suppose has a different frame of reference to the value that that we provide, which is a really exciting thing because... you know, I gave everything I could and more to that business. And, you know, I care about it deeply, but, you know, my future is elsewhere.
Yeah. Mate, a couple of things there. First, acknowledgement. As you said, you got in that tough time, but you built a community to be able to raise that money to get it out. And you've obviously done such a phenomenal job to build a strong community that got behind you when you were in that need. And then also built something that somebody else fell in love with enough to take that CEO role. And you don't pick up people at that level unless you've built something really solid that people want to jump into. So there's a strong acknowledgement there.
Yeah.
But then also the acknowledgement, and I've spoken to quite a few founders about this, where you're a founder, you're an ideas person, you're a builder, and then you get to that point in your career where, as on that startup journey, your job just becomes fundraising. And you're going through one fundraising round, and then you're just working on financials and then another fundraising round. And that's not the job a lot of founders signed up for. And it's you take the love out of what you're doing on a day-to-day basis. And I've spoken to a lot of founders just find that journey really challenging. And then you lose that love for it because it's, as you said, a really difficult time to go through that journey over and over.
Hmm. I'm in furious agreement with you. I don't know how it can be different. It has to. And founders should always be raising.
Yeah.
You know, CEOs always. Like, it's not something that I think if you're doing it well, you know, you're just constantly cultivating, you know, your audience of, you know, potential investors or potential sources of capital, you know, updating stakeholders. Like, it just should be this just constant fluid motion.
Yeah.
The thing, you know, I hope people see that I'm a transparent, you know, open book, because I feel that I am. But that can be exhausting as well, because you want to be straight and honest with people. So, like when you're making promises, you know, I'll describe it as, you know, giving away like pieces of your soul. You know, it is a really, I think for me, and I think for anyone that is taking external capital, you know, it is like something that needs to be treated with deep respect and reverence, that you're not going to be kind of frivolous with people's money and you're going to do what you say. And I always took that commitment very seriously.
Yeah.
And I think it's why, like, through the tough times, quitting was not an option.
Yeah.
We have to find a way through this. And
it takes its toll.
It does. But I know that's what investors look for. I'm trying to find a more sustainable way of, making a contribution, but also, you know, not being so kind of, like binary or like totally, on all the time.
Yeah. So. It's also a trait I imagine that makes you very backable second time around. And hopefully leads to some success again now. But big acknowledgement for that self-awareness to actually be in that position to realize, hey, I'm giving all I've got and I'm close to, there's no more to give.
Mm.
Because I think a lot of people get to that stage and just continue to burn and burn and burn. So
yeah,
I think that self-awareness stage is phenomenal to be able to make that decision, which I imagine was a very difficult decision, and then take the time. So
yeah,
if you had any advice for anyone else that might be in that same position at the moment, is there anything that you would... Did you take is that a little bit of time to understand where you're at and where you want to be? Is there any advice that you could give to anyone else that might be in a similar situation?
I think giving yourself permission to spend some time on yourself, and everyone's on their own journey and finding things that are that are helpful for you to, you know, be still and forgive yourself and forgive other people and like let go. And for me, that's been, you know, spirituality, particularly Eastern spirituality, things that I probably wasn't interested in, you know, many years ago, but have become more and more interested in over the last few years. And it's a daily practice. It's, you know, for me, what that looks like is, you know, meditation, breathing, you know, long walks, and just, I suppose, noticing, you know, my feelings and not getting too, not getting too wrapped up in them. Like everything passes, and, you know, being present is, should be the aspiration.
I love it. And I love it is an aspiration. It's so difficult to do. And I think, personality traits that lead to founders being successful in who they are, can be that all in, can look like ADHD sometimes. It can look like that all in mentality, and the self-awareness or the opportunity to take some peace, have a look at it from one step away, get out of the weeds, can be very challenging for founders, but also can be the best success or can lead to the biggest success because you can get out of the day-to-day and get have a look from a high perspective, because when you're the best version of you, you're going to be the best version of you as a leader, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So, mate, now we'll get on this exciting where we're at the moment. Talk to me about, you've had the 6 months off, AI is everywhere in technology at the moment. You've obviously played highly regulated fin services. I'm sure you've had multiple people knocking down your door. What's next for you? So, and what led you to the decision, to the journey you're on now?
I mean, like everyone, I've been super interested in AI. And I'm, you know, not going to kind of roll out the platitudes that people are about AI at the moment, but like I, you know, when GPT-3 was released, it, you know, really captivated me, and I've just been, you know, working with it as much as I can over the last few years. My time off really lent in to it. It was a great opportunity. You know, I found myself with time. I've used it personally for, you know, health and fitness and nutrition and spirituality, professionally to learn. It's incredible. And I was working with a handful of businesses, and that was a great way to kind of like ease myself back in. And I found myself in a position where, you know, the role I was in before is, you know, CEO of an intermediary platform, lots of interesting stuff comes across your desk, but conflicts everywhere. So you can't, you know, hop in with anyone. And then, you know, I was in this amazing new paradigm where, like, actually, I could start working more closely with these businesses. And Todd and what he's built at New Dialogue, and, you know, I was introduced to Todd through, you know, Brendan, a mutual friend of ours. Brendan's our head of revenue. But Todd was interested in, you know, working with me to look at what, you know, what he'd built at New Dialogue. And once I got my head around what it was and the opportunity, I got really excited. And like everything, you know, you just need to move fast. Like nothing has ever been, you know, that statement has never been true or more important. So, you know, I said to Todd, you know, I want to help you do this. Yeah. And yeah, we launched a few weeks ago, and the response has been phenomenal. Yeah. And, you know, we've got a product in market, which I think is rare at the moment. You know, yeah, there's lots of people wanting to, you know, operate in this space or, you know, talking about what New Dialogue has done. Now, that that will very soon kind of cease to be the case. There's lots of people that are going to kind of move into this area. I think it's a great thing because open source is, you know, we're high conviction that open source is the future for enterprise AI. And we can accelerate adoption by all of us working together and actually, you know, just getting started because so many businesses are seeing the world change around them and they don't know where to start.
Yeah, because I think where we're at right now, and it'll probably be different in a couple of weeks, a lot of individuals, as you said, have started with using ChatGPT or something like that and they're putting a little bit, it's helping them on an individual basis.
Yeah.
How can we do this from a commercial perspective? And it can be a bit loosey-goosey to start with. And I guess the big problem from where I see that you guys are coming in is enterprise level and highly regulated, because at the moment this is where the big challenges are. People using open source and then people just using feeding company data into there, unsecure,
yep,
unregulated. And is this where the problem is? This is sell for you guys at the moment, what you're doing? Is there any examples at the moment of companies you're working with that face these challenges? Because we've gone on this journey where data was everything, right? And everyone's got to get the data in the right spot. How can you architect and build your data lake and then get data engineers? And then we started with the ML, but everything was really secure on the data perspective to start with. And now I feel like we're in this space where people want to use that data, but we're also doing that and some AI. Like, this is the challenge and the opportunity at the moment.
Totally, totally. And I got to say, like, doing nothing is an increasingly untenable position. It's probably already untenable.
Yeah.
So from the top, you've got, you know, leaders who are probably using it personally and then, you know, saying down to their teams, like, why aren't we, you know, doing it? This is, you know, it's going to change everything. At a business level, you're probably dealing with, you know, IT, legal risk teams that are like, you know, I don't really understand what's going on here. My job is to protect, you know, the company and the data. Like, there's risks here. So they're kind of pumping the brakes because they can't get their heads around, you know, quite reasonably what's happening.
Correct. And from that, it's a safety perspective rather than an acceleration or a revenue opportunity perspective. It's that safety first perspective.
Absolutely. Then you've got, you know, workforces that are seeing the beginnings of, you know, people being, or companies like laying people off, looking for, you know, efficiency or cost out of the business. And then, you know, other people that are perhaps, you know, engaged or interested in the space that are, you know, listening to guys like Jeffrey Hinton and, you know, other guests on, you know, Diary of a CEO and others just saying, like, you know, the world's going to end.
Yeah.
You know, basically, we're all screwed. So it's fair for people to be terrified at the prospect of, you know, what we're moving into. I take a different approach. I'm an optimist, eternal optimist, and I think my spirituality and the journey that I've been on over the last few years is, you know, and this kind of practice of, like, focusing on the present, you know, tuning in to the signal, you know, kind of turning off the noise. I think it's a good way to be, because you're trying to be, you know, fluid and just embracing change. I think over time we're going to see that people, you know, this new divide or the, you know, a fault line between people that take you know, a growth mindset or a scarcity mindset to this change, that the people that excel are going to be the ones that really lean into change, and I think people that are resistant to change are going to struggle. So there's probably something, you know, at an individual personal development level for all of us in that. But what New Dialogue does essentially is helps organizations to drop an open source large language model into their own secure environment. Beautiful. And that's a pretty familiar strategy for tech leaders, that, okay, you know, behind our firewall, on-prem, You know, I get to understand the data never leaves. It's not just about data. It's about, privacy and security. It's also about being able to explain, how you're using the AI, being able to, provide information to an auditor or a regulator. All of this stuff is coming. I mean, it's already there.
Yeah.
We're calls for an AI act. I mean, a lot of this stuff already applies, right? It's just like the technology's there, but your obligations to explain how you're handling sensitive data, this is an enforcement issue. Now, I mean, without getting into the debate of whether or not we need a specific AI act or not, I'm often on the lines of if it's well drafted, then it can actually help industry because they know that's what we need to do.
Yeah.
But organizations aren't ready for this. And if you're using an opaque model, I mean, try explaining to someone like how it worked, rolling it back, saying what version of the model that you've actually used. So giving organizations control over this helps them to create a safe space where they can give their teams permission to speak freely with this amazing technology that they're already using in their private lives, perhaps already, using sensitive company data.
Potentially.
Yeah. But, and why are they doing that? Because they can see like the value of this technology to help them in their work. It's exciting because it's simple.
Yeah.
We're in market working with customers already that are seeing the value of our offering, and it's being validated by the recent moves of big tech players. OpenAI has just released its first open source model since 2019. Yeah. DeepSeek at the start of the year really shook things up for everyone. Model agnostic. Like we see a new model come to market. It's like, awesome. We get to play with something else. And, the new OpenAI models are incredible. GPT-5, I don't know, maybe when this is published, GPT-5 is going to be out and it's going to blow everyone's socks off. The cycle times are so fast at the moment.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to keep up, which I think my earlier point on, being fluid and present and just, trying to kind of focus on what matters, like this, focusing on the present and being calm is actually going to be a really important skill for everyone, because there's just so much noise and change at the moment.
And the change is consistent. That's going to be the only consistent, right, as you said. I think the big part for you, or the big sell, like from my perspective, is like that agnostic angle as well, is you're going to allow people to play with what tools they see best fit, and then you allow them to have that control in there. Because, as you said, a lot of times technology moves really quick and then the legal side, follows behind. And if you're not moving with it, all the organizations at the moment want to move and want to move quickly, but are being held back by the legal and compliance and risk angles at the moment. So there's that, as you said, that the different mindsets playing within organizations at the moment.
Yeah. Like a brief parallel to my experience building Birchall, but like 2016, 2017 was when we started working on it. 2017 was when the legislation was passed. Blockchain, ICOs, all the rage.
Yep.
And, here we were building a regulated business waiting for legislation and people just telling us, like, you're nuts. Like, technology's out here. People are raising, millions of dollars on a white paper and, this is going to be, and just saying like that was the future. Like you don't need, we're free from the shackles of regulation. And I was like, as a securities lawyer, I was just like, I can't see government acquiescing on this, giving up their right, their obligation and their duty to police this area. And I'm talking about blockchain rather than, Bitcoin in particular. We probably have another podcast talking about, cryptocurrencies. But that like we made a bet on regulation that you know, investors and people trust investing through a regulated environment, and like that was the right call. And you know, I think that should be the approach, making sure that the rules are right, because that protects us all. And I think it's a similar thing here, is that government's not, I just don't see government giving up. It's going to be hard. It's probably harder than it's ever been before because of the geopolitical issues and everyone's race to AGI. But it's part of the optimist in me, and you know, my training as a lawyer and officer of the court and the rule of law and what we have to protect. Otherwise, it's a state of nature, and you know, we're back to kind of tribalism, and I don't know that's good. You know, I still have faith in our institutions, and that's my frame of reference.
Yeah, as you said, for all the good that can be done with AI, there's another side to it.
Yeah,
without the guidelines. So, and I think that's again where you guys are playing. It's maybe not as sexy as just building something that moves so quickly, but it's actually building around regulations and frameworks and building for security. Is that part that's just the underlying foundations of which other things and the really cool things within an organization can move with a lot of speed?
Absolutely. And I had, I'm having so many amazing conversations with people at the moment. It's great to be like out of the trenches now. And, you know, this is what I'm working on, and, having like just great conversations with people that are working in the space. But, everyone's looking for these killer use cases, like, yep. Oh, AI is going to, do that. Highly valuable, like verticals. And I'm not saying that, those things won't be uncovered, won't be important. But, I think it will work best as a bottom-up evolution.
Yeah.
That, if you're trying to figure out how generative AI can, embed, solely embed within a workflow and, improve a certain process, if you haven't unleashed it onto your business and given them, everyone access to it and given people the opportunity to kind of bubble things up from a grassroots level, maybe it's the wrong process.
Yeah.
Maybe it's redundant and you don't need it anymore. So I think sometimes this hyper focus for things in an old paradigm, can be limiting.
Yeah.
And I think that's what positions us as a really compelling proposition, because, and I haven't kind of spent time talking about the genesis of New Dialogue, but it's being spun out of Centric Minds, which, is a 20-year-old business, has 500 clients around the world, some really impressive clients, government regulated businesses. They provide knowledge management software. They've been helping businesses with knowledge bases and intranets as an alternative to SharePoint, OneDrive. So businesses choosing Centric Minds over some of the biggest software companies in the world, but we saw that, that paradigm, well, we're under a new paradigm now where people want to talk to their data, and unlocking that knowledge and, getting that across teams, that's where the magic starts to happen. But you have to start there.
Yeah. Matt, I think the combination of that knowledge base, SaaS, enterprise level experience overlaid with everything you've done in around that startup space, worked with a number of different companies. I love the combination of experiences here that sets you up as a team really well to sort of to take on this space.
Absolutely.
So what I'm hearing though, your big solution here is an opportunity for putting in security in a base layer infrastructure to enable companies to really take advantage of AI in a safe and secure environment. That's
absolutely. And the key differentiator is rapid deployment, speed. Yep. So, if companies want to do this, typically it involves standing up, you know, very specialized engineering resources to deploy the open source model. And, you know, that can take months, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars in build if it's a large organization, ongoing OPEX.
Trying to find really good engineering talent.
Trying to find, which is getting harder, you know, $1.5 billion offered by Zuck to, you know, the Thinking Machines Lab guy from Perth. It was just incredible. But, you know, we can get companies online in days.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
So, you know, the way that we go to market typically is a $15,000 60-day pilot.
Yeah.
And, you know, we deploy in days, get the business rather than focusing on an engineering product. We've got a product that the engineering and tech team will understand, they can inspect, but then just give it to the business and let them do their thing and, you know, give them access to all of the company's knowledge. And then, you know, see what they do.
And I imagine they can section off different parts of the knowledge base so who can access what.
Absolutely. Like that's all of this stuff has been built in because they are things that, you know, 20 years of knowledge of building knowledge bases, customers expect. So, you know, that's the heritage of our product.
I love it. I think there's opportunities there where We'll see a lot of bad use cases at the moment within a company data being fed into an LLM, having access to, and then people's intricate data being accessible by other people. And
yeah,
we're going to see some bad PR around that, I imagine, over the coming weeks.
Yeah, of course. And look, I mean, to his credit, Sam Altman, you know, I mean, he's cautioning people on this stuff. Like he came out the other week on a podcast just telling people, like, you know, You know, don't share like confidential. Basically, don't trust us. I don't know if he actually said that directly, but he's, you know, reminding people that like stuff that you feed in, it can be, you know, discoverable under a legal process. So
if you're using it as your psychologist, as a psychiatrist, and which people are, good results sometimes at the moment.
Yeah, but
there's some danger and security elements to that.
We're all just figuring this out.
Yeah, mate, I love it. Do we have a it's moving so quickly at the moment. What's next 6 months, 12 months look like? Are we looking 12 months ahead? Do we have an idea, picture of what that looks like?
Anyone that has high conviction on what the future is going to look like, I think, is totally misguided at the moment. Yeah. As I was saying before, cycle time's so fast. It's which again, I think, is why it's daily practice. It's, you know, it's mindfulness. It's taking time out to just be still.
Yeah.
And keeping an open mind. It is a really exciting time for everyone. It can be daunting. So I think just taking the time to, be calm, but also get involved and be open.
You mentioned get involved. Any advice for places to go, people to follow when somebody's maybe a little bit behind the time or trying to catch up to what's going on? Do you have any people that you recommend to others?
I've been following Ethan Mollick's work for years because he was one of the early academics who was writing on equity crowdfunding years ago. And he's become, you know, a real thought leader in AI and does like incredible work, up to the minute, you know, work on all of the large language models. He gets early access to stuff. So, you know, if you're kind of following him, and you want to kind of stay up to the minute in this space, probably can't go wrong. Other than that, like Stephen Bartlett's Diary of a CEO.
He's had some phenomenal guests lately.
It's incredible. And I'm loving, I suppose, the evolution, like his journey and the things that you know that he's asking and he's learning. It's so AI focused at the moment, which is telling as well. Like it's the biggest story. Yeah. And
he's got different perspectives coming in there as well. As you said, you've got somebody super positive about the future, but it's got doomsday. But it's great to see there's the variety of different perspectives.
Yeah, absolutely. And then I think, you know, just staying ahead of the game. So like reading, you know, just staying involved and interested in what government is doing. So, you know, Productivity Summit's coming up. You know, follow the commentary on that to see how people are, positioning for this discourse. But productivity is going to be the biggest issue of this term of government, and AI is the biggest sub-issue of that issue. Yeah. So it's all about AI.
Yeah, well, that's the biggest driver, right? So also another place to follow. I know I've subscribed. You've got a newsletter coming out at the moment that you're publishing.
Yep.
Give us a quick overview of that and then a quick overview of where people can follow you and we'll wrap her up.
Yeah, awesome. Well, thanks for the reminder to plug myself. But, Open Dialogue. So we're publishing a weekly newsletter. It's your kind of three biggest stories in the world of AI. It's, you know, my lens. It's not just all of the American stuff as much as it is really important, but it's kind of looking at, you know, how this relates to Australians and Australia as well. And then also include some cool stuff like a AI-generated Nick Cave video, which I had this week. So, yeah, interesting stuff that I find from time to time. You can get it on LinkedIn.
Yeah, perfect. Follow Matt on LinkedIn.
On LinkedIn, yeah, find me on LinkedIn. I'm friendly and really enjoy the platform to start conversations with people. If you're an enterprise and you're thinking about how to start in your AI journey in a safe way, check out newdialogue.com or just reach out to me.
Beautiful. I appreciate your time today.
Thanks so much.
Cheers.
Yeah.